From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, John Bolton on the Warpath. That's the title of the new article by today's guest, New Yorker staff writer Dexter Filkins. Bolton is President Trump's hawkish national security advisor. He's a former Fox News commentator and former UN ambassador under George W. Bush. Bolton's aggressive worldview contrasts with Trump's isolationist tendencies. After President Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, Bolton said, "Homo sapiens are hardwired for violent conflict."
A person who worked with him for years said to me, his view of life is that it's, cold, nasty, brutish, and short.
Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the Netflix dark comedy series Dead to Me, starring Linda Cardellini and Christina Applegate. That's on Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast comes from the Neubauer Family Foundation, supporting WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation.
President Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, is known as a tough-talking hawk. A new article about him in The New Yorker is titled John Bolton on the Warpath. My guest is the author, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dexter Filkins, who's a staff writer for the magazine. He's joined us many times on the show, dating back to when he covered the war in Iraq. Bolton is President Trump's third national security advisor, after Generals Michael Flynn and H.R. McMaster. Trump was familiar with Bolton's views because Bolton had made hundreds of appearances on Fox News as a guest and then as a paid commentator. On Fox, he'd advocated for military strikes on Iranian training camps and for forced regime change in North Korea. Earlier in Bolton's career, he served in the George W. Bush administration as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs and as UN Ambassador. He advocated for the invasion of Iraq and told Filkins he still thinks the decision to overthrow Saddam Hussein was correct. Dexter Filkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. So, as you point out in the piece, the Trump administration has no permanent Secretary of Defense, no Secretary of Homeland Security, no ambassador to the UN. What does it mean in terms of the power John Bolton has now in his role as National Security Advisor?
Well, the National Security Advisor, just by virtue of the geography of that job, it's in the West Wing, it's right down the hall from the Oval Office. It's an incredibly powerful position. The Bolton sees a president every morning. He sees him, or he talks to him in the evening. It's just the proximity of that job to the presidency gives the occupant of that job just an enormous amount of power. So just on its face, you're in the pole position there. But I think in this administration, because, it's a revolving door in the rest of the government pretty much all the time, Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, he's gone. There's no replacement has been named. So there's an acting Secretary of Defense. There's no ambassador to the United Nations. There's no Secretary for Homeland Security. So it's just kind of a big vacuum. I think it's fair to say that makes his job even bigger and gives him even more influence than you would ordinarily have. So I think in that administration, when you're talking about foreign policy, you're basically talking about John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, and that's it.
And are they on the same page on most things, Pompeo and Bolton?
I think so. I had a funny conversation about Pompeo and Bolton together with an unnamed Western diplomat who knows them both. And they said, look, Pompeo is really only interested in what Trump is interested in, so you can't really sit down and talk about the world with him. Bolton, on the other hand, you can talk about anything. You talk about aid programs in Africa, and he's well-briefed. He knows about it. But Pompeo has a much more political outlook.
So you're saying Pompeo is there to amplify Trump's views. Bolton has very strong views of his own.
Yes, he does.
So the title of your piece is John Bolton on the Warpath. I know he's a hawk. Does the piece imply that he's going to lead us into war?
No, but I think it fairly raises a lot of questions. And I think the basis of the piece is this, which I was kind of surprised to find, this divergence of worldviews between Bolton, on the one hand, who's been a hawk his whole life. He's for aggressive use of American power. He's advocated bombing North Korea. He's advocated bombing Iran. And on the other hand, to the extent that President Trump has a worldview, it is he wants He wants to stay home. It's America first. He's pretty close to being an isolationist. He doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want to partake in this kind of entire international architecture that was set up after the Second World War, whether it's the World Trade Organization or NATO or EU. He doesn't want to pay for any of that stuff, and he doesn't want to get involved. So Trump, I think it's fair to say, doesn't want to launch new military operations. They do not see eye to eye on things. I tried to kind of, you know, figure out what it is they talk about when they get together for that reason.
If Trump and Bolton have such opposing worldviews when it comes to the possibility of military intervention or war, why would Trump choose him? Why did he choose him?
Well, I think there's that's a really good question. I think there's two reasons for that. One is that, you know, I think Bolton is kind of emotionally appealing to Trump. You know, Bolton was a very highly paid analyst on Fox News. He was on there a few times a week. One of the revelations is for me was I got to look at Mr. Bolton's financial disclosure, which you're required to submit for a job like that. And yeah, there was lots of stuff in there. So I think he was being paid $600,000 a year. This is just part of his income, but $600,000 a year to be on Fox. And so every night he's banging away, talking tough. And I think that appeals emotionally to Trump. He's like that. He's a tough guy. Plus, he just sees him all the time because they didn't really know each other very well. I think the other reason is H.R. McMaster had been the national security advisor before John Bolton. And there was a kind of a pretty large group of Trump allies who had decided that McMaster had to go. They didn't like him. They thought he wasn't supportive enough of Israel. And of, you know, the current leadership there. And so they pushed him out. I mean, I think it's fair to say they lobbied very hard to get him out. And they worked pretty hard to get Bolton in. So I think it was a confluence of those two things.
What did Bolton advocate for as a highly paid commentator on Fox News?
As I mentioned, I went through a lot of stuff that he said on the air. And you know, I think he's finding, I should say, but before I answer that question, I think he's finding, you know, it's a little different when you're in power as opposed to being out of power. But on Fox, talking tough, strike North Korea if necessary before they acquire an ICBM capability, strike Iran in various, you know, various ways and in various contexts. That's like at a minimum, and support Israel in its kind of what I think is a covert or actually pretty hot war that's going on with Iran and Syria. So really aggressive use of American power. But I think even more than that, not just dropping bombs. I think that Bolton's worldview is he's extremely skeptical of international agreements, whether they're treaties or, again, the whole kind of architecture that was built by the United States over the past 70 years, you know, whether it's NATO or the EU or the UN, or the World Trade Organization, all those things, which that, you know, that's the world we live in, and he is, and these are, you know, treaties and commitments and bilateral agreements, multilateral agreements. He is deeply skeptical of all those things, and he says essentially, he has said this on Fox News, but he's been very articulate about it in his writing, which is every time you sign a treaty or a multilateral agreement, you give up a little bit of your sovereignty, and so I think he sees his view of America is as a kind of colossus operating unilaterally wherever it wants. And, you know, if you pick up friends along the way, great, but they're not going to be your friends for long because there's no such things as friends in the international system. There's only interests, and only interests endure. And so don't get sentimental about it. Just carry on. And I think that it's a very unsentimental view of the world that he has.
Okay, but Trump fell in love with with Kim Jong-un. And, I mean, they seem to have such different approaches to viewing the world, even when they agree on things. Because, you know, Trump is very sentimental and very angry, you know, like depending on what mode he's in. But you know, in terms of war, an aide one of Trump's aides told you that he overheard Trump's end of the conversation with his former national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. And even though he was forcing out H.R. McMaster, he called him to run ideas past him about who his successor should be. And when he mentioned Bolton, the aide said that he heard Trump say, "Bolton is a hawk like you. He's going to get us into a war." So if Trump thinks that Bolton is going to get us into a war, and if Trump doesn't want to get into a war, it again seems like it's going to be a weird ride with the two of them.
It's going to be a weird ride. It is. And I think the question is, you know, what happens out there in the world and kind of how it develops. Because I think Bolton's view is, you know, Bolton's worldview is pretty clear. I think we're seeing that kind of play out at the moment in Venezuela. But, I mean, think of, you mentioned North Korea. I mean, think of how I started my piece with the scene in North Korea, because I talked to a lot of people who were in Vietnam for the summit to discuss with Kim Jong-un. And so on one end, you have the president saying, "We fell in love. I can do a deal. I can make a treaty with these people. I can persuade them to basically disarm." And on the other hand, and, you know, Bolton is in the room at the table sitting next to the president, and he has written forcefully that we need to attack North Korea. We need to bomb North Korea and destroy their nuclear capability. And so I tried to kind of – I posed that question to Bolton. I said, you know, how could you do that? You know, how could you sit down at that summit when you have been mocking every American diplomat who has done that for the past 20 years, and there you are doing the same thing yourself. And Bolton said to me, "Well, you know, when you take a job like this, you have to realize you're not going to win everyone. You have to compromise," and, you know, perfectly reasonable answer. But you know, he has been utterly dismissive of the entire American effort to kind of diplomatically engage North Korea for the past 20 years to try to persuade them peacefully to give up the nuclear program. Bolton is right. That effort has failed. But the solution is, you know, what is the solution? Basically, the solution that he's pretty clearly advocated is war. So how does Trump get his head around all that? It's a really good question. I think the conversation that you mentioned, "You're going to get us into a war," it sounds like Trump is kind of appropriately skeptical. Like, I'm going to hire this guy. But I'm going to be careful as well.
There's one more thing about war. After President Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, Bolton said, "Homo sapiens are hardwired for violent conflict." So it sounds like he accepts wars just like the natural scheme of things. Like, of course we're going to get into wars.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, a person who worked with him for years said to me, you know, his view of life is that it's, you know, cold, nasty, brutish, and short. And I, you know, I think, you know, the world is a bad neighborhood. It is. And so I, you know, I think that any diplomat would go into, sort of venture out into the world with a view sort of along that way. I'm going into a bad neighborhood, and I gotta have you know, I got to have my hand on my hip and be ready to draw. The question is, you know, how quickly you draw that gun. And I think that from his writing and from, you know, years of writing, I think he has 600 newspaper articles or magazine articles over the years. All of his talks and speeches and his statements on Fox News and the like, he indicates he'd be pretty fast on the draw. And so the question, I think, properly to be raised is he going to give diplomacy a chance, or does he reach for that gun first?
So as we record this, in Venezuela, there is an attempt by the opposition, by many Venezuelans, by part of the military, to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. Venezuela has just been falling apart economically in every way. And you write that Bolton was leading the fight against Maduro, you know, in the U.S., accusing him of forming, along with Cuba and Nicaragua, a troika of tyranny in the Western Hemisphere. You were with Bolton in Miami when he addressed, well, tell us who he addressed and tell us what some of the things he said.
Well, it's pretty amazing. It was just a couple weeks ago. I went down to Miami with Bolton. He addressed a convention of the surviving members of the 2506 Brigade, and that's the now aging Cuban veterans of the Bay of Pigs invasion. You know, the failed invasion in 1961, and so they're pretty hardcore anti-communist and. They love Bolton. I mean, you know, he walked into the room and it was like they went crazy. And some of them were in wheelchairs and they were, you know, climbing up out of their wheelchairs to applaud him. But the Bolton gave and he's, you know, he's done this before, but he gave a very tough talk first about Cuba, but then sagging very quickly to Venezuela, and which I think ultimately is. You know, that's topic A right now. And so he made it very clear that Maduro has to go and that the Cubans who are in Venezuela have to go, that the Russians who are in Venezuela have to go, and that the best way to do that is to change the regime. And I talked to him about it afterwards, and it was remarkable really how blunt he was. I mean, he basically said, the Western Hemisphere, that's ours. Russians out, and the Monroe Doctrine is alive and well. And you know, the Monroe Doctrine basically says the hemisphere is ours. But I think that what struck me there in Miami was not just what was happening in Venezuela, which is, you know, unfolding as we speak, but what was interesting to me was that in Miami this was essentially a political speech. This was a campaign speech, and I mean an American presidential campaign speech. The you know, if you take the Venezuelans in Florida and the Cubans and the Nicaraguans, I mean, I think you have about a million and a half in Florida. And Florida, of course, is the critical state that Trump needs to win the presidency. And they love nothing more than, you know, the Cuban exiles there, particularly the older ones. They love nothing more than to hear a table-pounding speech about how we're going to roll back the lefties in the hemisphere, and they were loving it, and they were eating it up. And I think the whole discussion, the whole speech, was about foreign policy, but it kind of struck me as first and foremost a domestic political speech. Again, as these events are unfolding in Venezuela.
Okay, but you're right. With the 2020 elections looming, the prospect of appealing to voters may create a strong temptation to launch a military intervention. Are you talking about a military intervention in Venezuela?
Yes, and I, you know, the administration's been very clear about it. I mean, Bolton was. I asked him directly, and he could have said no. He said to the contrary. He said all options are on the table, and he said that to get the Russians out, we got to change the regime. So I think Maduro. Yeah, Maduro's finished. It's just a question of time because this administration is not going to permit Maduro to stay, and so I think. You know, we're watching this unfold in Venezuela right now. It's just really, I don't want to say it's a matter of time because, of course, events could unfold in any number of ways. But this administration is strongly behind the uprising behind Juan Guaido, the who's leading the opposition.
So if we do any kind of military intervention in Venezuela, are we in some ways in conflict with Russia?
Definitely.
I mean, a military conflict.
Well, I think that I think we're a long way from a military intervention. We're a long way. I mean, the administration is four square behind Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, and they're supporting him in every way. And it's impossible. I mean, I don't know the facts on the ground, but it's hard for me to imagine that Guaido would be calling for an uprising in the way that he is without at least the tacit approval of the United States and without the tacit approval of the White House. But I think that our objective is to push the Russians out of the hemisphere and make it clear once again, a la the Monroe Doctrine, that this hemisphere is ours. And I think Putin's probably watching all that very carefully. I doubt we're going to come into conflict, armed conflict, with any Russians. But I think that the objective of the White House is to clear the Cubans and the Russians from Venezuela and the Maduro regime as well.
Bolton has been tweeting a lot. He's been directly tweeting the people of Venezuela to overthrow Maduro. He's been tweeting leaders of the Maduro administration to leave, that, you know, like, you know what the right thing to do is, leave.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that sounds kind of unprecedented to you. I mean, I know Twitter's kind of new in the world of diplomacy, but to directly address not just the people of Venezuela, but the leaders of, you know, Maduro's administration or regime, depending on how you want to look at it, and tell them to leave.
Yeah, I think it is remarkable. The National Security Advisor is typically and historically is not someone who gets out in the public and bangs the drum. And Bolton's doing that, you know, with his tweets, with his political speeches. He's really, really vocal, and he's really out front. And that's remarkable.
My guest is Dexter Filkins. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his new article is titled John Bolton on the Warpath. We'll talk more about John Bolton after we take a short break. And our TV critic, David Bianculli, will review the new Netflix dark comedy series Dead to Me, about two women dealing with grief issues, played by Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Mayo Clinic. When you're looking for advice you and your family can trust, and you want support from people who can give you the certainty you need, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. Find out more at mayoclinic.org/answers.
We're talking about President Trump's tough-talking, hawkish national security advisor, John Bolton. My guest, Dexter Filkins, is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's written a new article about Bolton called John Bolton on the Warpath. Bolton is President Trump's third national security advisor after Generals Michael Flynn and H.R. McMaster. Trump was familiar with Bolton's views because Bolton had made hundreds of appearances on Fox News as a guest and then as a paid commentator. On Fox, he'd advocated for military strikes on Iranian training camps and for forced regime change in North Korea. So you describe John Bolton as a ferocious critic of Iran. And when he moved into his office as national security advisor in the Trump administration, he hung a framed copy of Trump's executive order nullifying the nuclear agreement with Iran. I'm sure President Trump liked that because it was his order. But did you see it when you interviewed Bolton? Did you see it framed?
Yeah. He gave me a little tour around the office, and that was the first thing he pointed to. He said, "You know, this is the executive order nullifying the agreement with Iran." He was very happy about that.
So why did he hate the deal so much?
That's a good question. I think somebody told me in my piece that Bolton has a kind of anal obsession with Iran, which is like not explicable. I think Bolton would, in his defense, he would say, in fact, I asked him this question. I said, "Why are you obsessed with Iran?" And he said, "Because of nuclear weapons. That's why I think about Iran." And his aide said to me, the first thing John thinks about when he wakes up in the morning is how to protect the American people from the threat of nuclear weapons. And so, none of which is unreasonable. I think that their view of Iran is just very, very dark. And it's much darker than the Obama administration, the view that the Obama administration had. The Obama White House basically saw Iran and they thought, okay, look, these guys are doing bad stuff all around the world. They're not particularly nice people, but we can make a deal with them, and we can make a deal that's verifiable, and which will be in everyone's interest. We can try to stop their very deliberate progress towards acquiring a nuclear weapon, and the rest of it, you know, we just hold our nose. And that was like the Obama view. And I think the Bolton view, and it's not necessarily Trump's view, but the sort of Bolton represents a huge part of Washington that believes that Iran is not just a serious threat, but cannot be trusted to make a deal, and basically the regime there has to be changed as well. And I think they don't really say that publicly, They're not allowed to use the words regime change, but they're trying to cripple the economy. And I think they're making a lot of progress on that front. So I think that cancel the nuclear agreement on one hand and crush the economy on the other, and let's see where that goes. As a senior administration official said to me, if we cripple the economy, which I think we can do, and the Iranian people decide that in their anger that they want to get rid of their government, well, you know, good luck to them. And I think that's kind of where we are. That's the White House policy towards Iran right now.
But you know, somebody else told you that the Obama administration sanctions were to punish the Iranian regime, but these new sanctions are punishing the Iranian people. And people expressed to you in the piece the fear that the sanctions are so tight they will lead to war with Iran as opposed to a regime change.
Well, I think that's one of the fears. I think one of the things that the United States kind of bureaucracy, I should say, the kind of the experts in the government have learned over the past decade or so is just how sweeping American sanctions can be, particularly with regard to financial controls and financial sanctions. The United States essentially controls the international financial system, and so if the right restrictions are put in place, you can, which I think we're seeing now in Iran, you really can cripple an economy. And so what the Trump administration is trying to do with Iran right now is basically shut down as completely as possible their ability to export oil, and that's, you know, that's like 90% of their government revenue. It shut down their ability to export oil and then basically drive the economy to collapse. And I have to say they're making a lot of progress in that regard. I think when Trump came into power, the Iranians were exporting something like 2.9 million barrels of oil a day. They're now below a million, and the Trump White House is going to keep pushing that lower. Inflation is galloping in Iran. Unemployment is very, very high. So they're doing, I think they're achieving their objective, which is at the moment, which is to cripple the Iranian economy. What comes out of that, you know, that's kind of anyone's guess. I think pretty strongly that they can essentially foment an uprising or foment a collapse of the regime. A lot of people I talk to are pretty skeptical of that. You know, yes, they can collapse the economy, but does that necessarily take us where we want to go? Does that necessarily change the regime? And because like the regime, you know, the people at the top, they're always the last people to suffer. They're always going to eat well, and they have, you know, their bank accounts abroad. So we know that the Iranian regime is willing to kill as many people, kill as many Iranians as they need to stay in power, as we saw in 2009. So where does this all go? Unclear. But the they think they can, yeah, if we make the Iranian people miserable enough, they will rise up.
Let's talk about John Bolton's background. He was in the George W. Bush administration, first as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs, then as U.N. Ambassador. He was a controversial pick for U.N. Ambassador. He never got out of committee, but he managed to get the position anyways. So refresh our memory about how he managed to become U.N. Ambassador.
Well, it's pretty amazing. It really is, because when Bolton was nominated to become ambassador of the United Nations, first of all, it was in the middle of the Iraq War, so it was, you know, it was a pretty ugly time, and there was a lot of anger against the White House, and so they nominated their most vocal hawk to go to New York, and in the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq, there was a a diplomat at the at a Brazilian diplomat who worked for the what's called the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is like virtually every country in the world is part of. It's like 189 countries, including the United States. It basically bans chemical weapons, but it also if you become a signatory to that convention, then there's a mandate for kind of automatic, you know, independent inspections to make sure that you're not. You know, that you're not violating the treaty and you're not manufacturing chemical weapons. So this Brazilian diplomat who was working for the Chemical Weapons Convention, I think in The Hague, was negotiating with Saddam Hussein's government to join the Chemical Weapons Convention. And the Iraqis were basically – the Iraqi government indicated a willingness to join. And I think, in fact, they may have for a time actually joined. And whereupon there would have been automatic inspections, chemical weapons inspections. So I interviewed Bustani, and again, this is 2002. It's, you know, in the run-up to the invasion. And if you think back to that time in 2002, kind of a lot of people had a sense that kind of that was the direction that the Americans were going, and it wasn't a huge mystery. So Bustani told me I thought that if I could engage the Iraqi government and I could send these inspectors in, they could go in and they could determine, because we didn't think that they had a chemical weapons production capability. We could basically show that and we could maybe help stave off an invasion and say, look, the Iraqis don't – they let us in. They don't have chemical weapons. And so he was working towards that end and I think, you know, pretty earnestly. In the run-up to the war, so one day after the Iraqis had indicated that they were willing to sign and willing to come on board and allow inspections, John Bolton turned up in his office in The Hague and, you know, closed the door and sat down and said, I'm here at the request of Vice President Cheney and we would like you to resign. And Bustani was kind of stunned, as he described to me, and he said, "I refused." And then he said, Bolton threatened him and threatened his family, and he said, "Look, we want you to quit. We know where your daughters live. We know where your sons live. We know where your wife lives. It's time for you to go." And Bustani told me, "I was shocked. But I." Stuck to my guns. I said, no, you know, I'm not afraid of you. And so the United States, Bolton left, went home. He denies this, of course, but Bolton went home. The United States kind of orchestrated, all this is public record, but the United States orchestrated kind of Bustani's firing. They called for a special gathering of all the 189 member states. They kind of, you know, lobbied very hard for him to be removed, and he was.
If the story is correct, I mean, I know Bolton denies saying this, but if the story is true, that he actually threatened Bustani and said, look, we know where your wife and your children are, that's really mafia talk.
Yeah, that's. I think Bustani said the same thing to me. I mean, he said, I felt like it was in a movie, like a mafia movie or something. You know, let's assume for a second it's true. Yeah, maybe that's what, you know, hardcore, sharp-elbowed diplomats do behind closed doors. I doubt it, but it seems kind of shocking if it's actually true.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins, a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new piece is about President Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, who was George W. Bush's U.N. ambassador, and in between was paid commentator on Fox News. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor OnStar. With OnStar Stolen Vehicle Slowdown, a specially trained advisor can work with law enforcement to help locate, slow down, and recover a stolen vehicle quicker and safer. OnStar, be safe out there. OnStar is available on Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, and Cadillac. Requires select paid plan, cell reception, GPS signal, and working electrical system. Doesn't prevent theft, damage, or loss. Details at OnStar.com.
Weight can be a thorny topic, but Life Kit is here to give you the facts.
The scale measures the gravitational pull of the Earth at a given moment in time. The scale doesn't measure health, happiness, success, effort, or self-worth.
Here at LifeKit, we're rethinking weight. Find it wherever you're listening or at npr.org/LifeKit.
My guest is Dexter Filkins. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new piece is called John Bolton on the Warpath. John Bolton is President Trump's national security advisor. Let's talk about Bolton's background. In 1985, Bolton joined the Reagan Justice Department, and there he helped shepherd in the Supreme Court nomination of Robert Bork. He did not get confirmed in the Senate, and as you say, that began the era of fiercely partisan high court nominations. I think Bork went on to found or co-found the Federalist Society, the group of very conservative, you know, lawyers. So what were Bolton's priorities back then? Do you know?
It's again, he's been a conservative his whole life. If you go back, when Bolton got out of law school, he was an assistant to his Yale law professor, Ralph Winter. And Ralph Winter is a very well-known figure in the conservative intellectual movement. And when Bolton got out of law school, he joined up with Winter. So he's just in his 20s. They take this, what turns out to be a landmark Supreme Court case, Buckley versus Valeo, in which was the first big lawsuit, kind of the precursor to Citizens United. It was the first big lawsuit that challenged restrictions on campaign spending and giving. And they won. And essentially, it was Buckley versus Valeo, a landmark case. It established essentially that money and political contributions is essentially political speech. And that ultimately led to rulings like Citizens United, which have basically just unleashed, you know, as we now have the system, we now have this massive flood of private money into our campaigns. And that was the beginning. And Bolton was involved in that when he was just in his 20s. And he was involved in the Bork nomination, and he was involved in the Iraq War. So you can just chart his career, and it takes you through the whole rise of the Republican establishment as we now know it.
Is there anything I left out of the interview that you that you think is really important and you want to share with us before we have to end?
Yeah. I think there's one. You know, Bolton has aggressively advocated attacking North Korea for years. And I had a conversation with Larry Wilkerson, who was chief of staff at Colin Powell, and Bolton was essentially advocating, you know, preemptive war with North Korea in the early 2000s, like after 9/11. He was going around saying they've got this nuclear program. We have to act now and take them out. And it was so disturbing to Wilkerson that, and there's a scene in the piece where he said we had to find a way to shut him up. And he said we arranged for a briefing for Bolton. So we brought him into the room. He and Richard Armitage, who was the Deputy Secretary of State, and we gave him a briefing on what would happen if we went to war with North Korea. And as Wilkerson said to me, he said it's, you know, tens of thousands of casualties, and they kind of laid it out. He said we laid it out for John, like how many South Koreans would die, how many Americans would die. There's 200,000 Americans in Seoul. How many Japanese would die? How many Chinese would die? And he said, I'll never forget what Bolton said to me. He looked at me and he said, are you finished now? You clearly do war. I don't do war. I do policy. And I think that for Wilkerson, you know, that really stunned him. And I think their relationship has never been the same since. But it struck him as a very cavalier attitude towards going to war, having a war like that. And I just one more thing about North Korea. I remember when I was on the plane of then Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. This is in 2017, and the subject of North Korea came up, and he said if there was a war with North Korea would be bloodier than it would be a bloodier war than anyone alive has seen. That's how bad it would be. I mean, he got very sober very fast. And so that struck me as a pretty remarkable moment.
And I guess a question that we're left with is, you know, there's a difference between recommending policy and being responsible for pushing us into a military conflict with devastating consequences and tens of thousands of deaths. Would Bolton go to the point where tens of thousands of deaths were kind of, you know, that he'd be responsible for the action that led to it? Is he?
Well, that's a really good point. Look, it's one thing to be a highly paid commentator on Fox News and to say we should bomb North Korea, we should bomb Iran, we need to take action. Regardless, go forward, damn the torpedoes. That's one thing. But when you're actually, in the cockpit and you're flying a plane and you got to drop that bomb yourself, it starts to look a little bit different. And I think I don't know. I think this brings us to Bolton in Vietnam, sitting next to President Trump, sitting across the table from the North Korean leaders in negotiating their nuclear weapons. You never could have imagined that John Bolton, who has made fun of and mocked, every American diplomat who has ever done that, he's sitting there in the same chair himself, doing exactly the same thing. He didn't say it in quite that way to me, but I think you can imagine that you can't speak as freely and as loosely when you're the national security advisor, as opposed to when you're a commentator on Fox News, and I think he's finding that out right now.
Well, Dexter Filkins, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new article is titled John Bolton on the Warpath. After we take a short break, our TV critic David Bianculli will review the new Netflix dark comedy series Dead to Me, about two women dealing with grief issues, played by Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wix.com. With Wix, you can create your very own professional website. Choose a designer-made template or let Wix Artificial Design Intelligence build your site for you. With advanced design features, you can tell your story exactly the way you want. It's easy to start a blog, an online store, or create an event. And you can share it all on social media in a click. Get started now by going to Wix.com. That's Wix.com/freshair to get 10% off.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah. Just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
Tomorrow, Netflix presents a new 10-part series, a very dark comedy called Dead to Me. It's about two women who meet at a therapy group to deal with grief issues. They're played by Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. And our TV critic David Bianculli says these actresses, like their characters and this new TV series, offer up one delightful surprise after another.
Based on their breakout roles as young actresses, Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini, the stars of Netflix's wonderful new Dead to Me, couldn't be more different. Applegate became a star playing clueless, self-absorbed teen sexpot Kelly Bundy on Married with Children, the crass sitcom that helped launch the Fox network back in the 80s. Cardellini, on the other end of the TV and comedy spectrum, starred as the sardonic outcast Lindsay, the central character in NBC's Freaks and Geeks at the end of the 90s. Married with Children lasted a decade. Freaks and Geeks was canceled after one brilliant season, but its reputation lives on. So does its influence, because Freaks and Geeks was the spawning ground for Judd Apatow and his entire comedy world. That world includes, of course, the movie comedy hit Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, which was produced by Apatow, starred Applegate and Will Ferrell, and was directed by Adam McKay. Ferrell and McKay are the executive producers of Dead to Me, re-teaming with Applegate, and pairing her with Cardellini, who's since had memorable roles on ER, Mad Men, and the current Avengers Endgame film. The other key contributor here is Liz Feldman, the writer-producer who created Dead to Me. Her credits include the CBS sitcom Two Broke Girls, but Dead to Me is so, so much better than that. It's her career-best work. And it's the career-best work for Applegate and Cardellini, too. Applegate stars as Jen, a recent widow with two young boys and a long string of anger issues. She's still dealing with the sudden death of her husband, and in the very first scene defines her character with withering sarcasm when a married neighbor in her Southern California suburb shows up at her front door with a gift. It's a sort of sympathy casserole, a ready-made meal, and Jen accepts it, but not very graciously.
So you just heat it up at 300 and leave it in for 35 minutes.
Thanks, Karen, but you really don't have to.
It's my take on Mexican lasagna.
Great.
It's nothing. We just don't want you to think you're alone. Jeff and I are here for you if you ever want to talk.
Thanks.
Just can't imagine what you're going through.
Well, it's like if Jeff got hit by a car and died suddenly and violently. Like that.
Right.
Jen has so much seething resentment, she visits a grief therapy group where she meets Judy, a woman with her own issues of loss. She's played by Linda Cardellini. And while Judy is receptive to the soothing words of guidance from the group's pastor, Jen is a lot less open to the entire concept of emotional healing.
So last week we started talking about the F word. Forgiveness. Forgiveness can be very difficult, and it can take time, even a lifetime. But no matter what the circumstances, everyone is deserving of forgiveness.
You really think that?
Jesus thought that.
Amen.
How do you forgive someone who hits your husband with their car and then drives away, leaving him to bleed to death on the side of the road? How do you forgive that?
Yet somehow, Judy cracks through Jen's shell, and the two end up spilling secrets and answering each other's questions in an increasingly intimate, all-night spontaneous phone conversation. As when Judy keeps encouraging Jen to talk about her late husband.
Did your husband really like running? I'm sorry. You don't have to talk about him if you don't want to.
No, he liked running. Came to it later in life. He was 40.
What made him start?
He was...
getting doughy.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And get that middle-aged man puff.
Yeah, I mean, he had a full-on beer belly. He's getting a beer neck.
Beer neck?
So, he started running. I was proud of him.
He was in the best shape of his life when the car hit him.
By the time the sun comes up and the women hang up, Jen and Judy are close friends. And Dead to Me seems set on the path to becoming a redeeming, heartwarming buddy comedy. But this is where Liz Feldman starts defying expectations in a way that is so unexpected, so creative, and so effective that I don't even want to reveal what happens. Let me put it this way. You know the season one cliffhanger that pulled the rug from under NBC's The Good Place and redefined everything? Dead to Me pulls off a similarly stunning switcheroo in the very first episode, more than once. And by the time the first season's 10 episodes are over, and I've seen and loved them all, you're likely to be amazed by the journey these characters and this show have taken. Dead to Me also includes dynamic supporting work from James Marsden and, in a small but very touching and effective role, Ed Asner. But this series belongs to its two female leads, and they're incredibly good. Both Applegate and Cardellini play their scenes vulnerably and intensely, and embody fully believable characters. When they share the screen, whether they're bonding or arguing, Dead to Me becomes something truly special. Like BBC America's Killing Eve, Netflix's Dead to Me is a terrific character study of two women with an extremely complicated relationship. And also like that show, is one of the best and most unpredictable series on television this season.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. He reviewed the new Netflix series, Dead to Me. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zadie, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. I'm Terry Gross.